This Week in Radio Tech is supported by the Broadcaster's Desktop Resource at thebdr.net. That's THEBDR.net.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twert.
It only took us 5 episodes, but we figured out the future of radio. Stay tuned.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up, Dad?
All your data belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
On this show, it's the Geek Jedi. Chris Tobin, Tom Ray, and a special guest from Melbourne, Australia, Peter Smirk.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Hey, how you doing? It's Kirk Harnack, and you're tuned in to This Week in Radio Tech. We're so glad to have you in here. We have a cast of characters joining us today to talk about radio technology, all the things that have to do with studios and audio and RF technology, transmission, audio processing, and getting audio from here to there and trying to make it sound good. And that's what we do as broadcast engineers. I want to bring people up here, maybe a little different order than usual. I'm going to do this by the order they appear on my Skype panel, so I don't miss anybody. First of all, Chris Tarr from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Chris.
Hello there.
Chris is the Geek Jedi, also known as Awesome, and Broadcast Doc. Chris, what do you do there in Milwaukee?
I'm the Director of Engineering for Intercom's radio stations in Milwaukee and Madison, so that's 1 a.m. and 5 FMs.
6 stations altogether.
Oh, yeah.
Keeps you hopping.
It sure does.
Also with us from Down Under, we are really pleased to have a guest for the whole show. He's going to add his comments here and there throughout, and that is Peter Smirden. Hello, Peter.
G'day there, Kirk. How are you?
I'm great, and it's evening here in the U.S., about 8 o'clock Eastern Time, 7 o'clock Central. How is it where you are, Peter?
It's right on midday.
Midday, and except you're a day ahead. It must be Thursday there.
Midday Thursday, yep.
So, Peter, I understand you're recently retired, and you were the director of engineering or chief engineer for some radio stations there in Melbourne. Is that right?
Yep. I was chief engineer for the Pacific Star Network, which is a Melbourne-based operation with 2 AM radio stations, SEN Radio, which is a talk sport station, and 3MP, which is an easy listening music station. Both AMs. Here in this side of the world, we still have music on some AM stations, surprisingly.
Uh-huh. Well, good. And so now you're retired from that, but you're still available to do contract engineering and help people with your specialties, which might be AM transmission,
Yep. AM transmission is, I guess, my strong area. Analog studio systems, and also now of DAB digital radio, because in Australia just earlier this year we launched digital radio, and I was very heavily involved in that.
I'd be very eager to hear about that as the show goes on. Also with us from New York City is Thomas R. Ray III. Hello, Tom.
Good evening, Kirk. How you doing?
I'm good. Actually, you're probably talking to us not from New York City, but from your lair of amateur radio operations.
Yes, my humble abode up here in the New Windsor area, which is about 50 miles north of New York City.
Someday, Tom, I need to get you some pictures of your ham shack on the website. And eventually, when we do get around to doing a video version of this podcast, we'll get to see you in your ham shack, yeah?
Well, of course. And I'll see if I can get you some pictures this weekend. But, seeing as Peter's a day ahead, both your next guest and myself would like to know, seeing as he's a day ahead and it's already Thursday there, how did the Yankees do tonight?
I knew that was coming along. How did the Yankees?
I need to go find my bookie.
Tom, we should tell you, Tom is the Vice President of Engineering for Buckley Broadcasting, if you didn't already say that, Tom. And you're involved also with WOR and WOR's networks, yeah?
Yes, and I also have a Facebook page if you want to go look me up there. It's, I believe I'm Thomas R. Ray III, but just look up Tom Ray in New York City. You can't miss me.
All right.
Also, I'm the guy with the tower growing out of my head.
Yeah. Is that one of your new towers?
Or is yes, it? Sure is. That, the matter of fact, that picture is with tower number 3. Tower that's closest to the building.
In the New Jersey Meadowlands.
In the New Jersey Meadowlands, the wonderful place where you need a gas. I mean, no, it's a marvelous place.
Hey, your towers have a new governor.
Yes, I noticed that. But the good news is to our city of license still has the same mayor.
With us also from New York City is Chris Tobin from CBS Radio. Hello, Chris.
Good evening. How are you?
We're good. Glad to have you along. What's happening with Chris Tobin?
Oh, we're just having a good time here in New York City, as you know, with the six radio stations that I work with, three AMs and three FMs. Of the three AMs, two news and one all sports. New York Yankees is top of mind this week, so it's pretty much consuming everything we do.
I'll bet.
And, of course, the winning team tonight being the Yankees. Oh, did I say that? I'm sorry. Well, it's been a very busy week, which has been great.
One more disclaimer. I'm Kirk Harnack, and my employer is Telos Systems, owner of Telos, Omnia, and Axia Trademarks and Equipment Lines, and also Linear Acoustic, a new line that the Telos merged with that makes audio processors for television stations. So thank them very much for paying me enough of a salary where I can actually take a Wednesday evening off and do a podcast. So those are our perhaps our prejudices from our bread and butter life. And why don't we kind of move right into the podcast? By the way, I want to encourage you, if you're a listener, please tell your friends about us. You can follow a little bit about us on the web at thisweekinradiotech.com. That's where you can download the podcast. You can also subscribe to the podcast for free at the iTunes store. There's also an RSS feed link on the web page at thisweekinradiotech.com. So if you use an RSS newsreader, you can do that, and you'll be alerted of new episodes generally every week on the podcast. I want to jump right in because Chris Tobin was just talking about sports and that he has responsibility for a number of radio stations in New York City. An article that I was just looking at in Radio World, the online edition, and the article is talking about CBS Radio distributing some radio stations to other markets using HD2 and HD3 channels. Chris, is this a new idea, or are other people doing this, and how are you guys making that happen?
It's a new idea. I think what it is the look at non-traditional revenue and trying to find ways to extend the brand. I'll use the terminology of the day. And our sports product, the sports brand here at CBS, is quite popular in every market that it's native to. So in the case of New York City, it's WFAN. In Boston, WBZ, and then Detroit or Chicago, we have a few others. So the thought was HD2, HD3, and various markets would serve an ideal place to extend what we do. And I think in Hartford, Connecticut, right, Tom, there's somebody doing local sports on HD 2 or 3?
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, I believe that's WPOP on 1410.
Right. So the thought was, why not extend the popular brands? Because we at WFAN, I can say that we receive phone calls from a lot of folks from all over the East Coast from the website. They listen to the station that way, the streaming on the website. So the thought was, bring it to the local markets and see how we can develop it. So far, it's worked out very well. What we're doing is distributing the audio through IP over the company WAN so that it's a little easier than putting in T1s, ISDNs, and all the other crazy stuff you could choose.
This going by IP over the company WAN. That's interesting. So it's
yes.
It's already compressed to some degree from New York where you're streaming it out, correct?
Yes, yes. It's coming off the studio pre-processing in analog form, gets encoded into a MP2 stream, I believe, at 256.
Sure.
I have to double check.
That would be very reasonable. Sure.
Yes, yes. It's in mono, so we're trying to maximize the bits, if you will. And so far, it sounds really, really nice. I think the trick is the HD2 and HD3 encoding at the local station. That's where we have to be a little more tight as to how we process and what's going on. But so far, it's worked out well.
Wow, that's really, and so according to the article, you guys are moving. Let's see, some of these, like The Fan, WFAN, in New York, it's at 660 on the AM dial, but that's being sent to three Florida cities,
yes.
Orlando, Tampa, and West Palm Beach.
That's correct. And they're selling inventory separately. Commercials will be siphoned out, and local spots will be entered in. It's sports is universal. And I think we're finding that a lot of folks enjoy the sports from other parts of the country. Just as I know I have friends who are from the UK who live here in New York City, the Manchester games come up and we're off to the local pub and having a good time. And it's universal. It doesn't matter whether it's football, baseball, cricket. It's interesting. Sports folks enjoy it. They don't draw a line in the sand.
As a conversation starter, I'll say I think this is a great idea for quality programming on HD channels. And here's why. because the stations that CBS is distributing to other cities, these sports stations, also I noticed that K-Rock, K-R-O-Q in Los Angeles, another station in, let's see, in KSCF in San Diego, for example, they're being piped over to Los Angeles. WBZ in Boston is another one. These stations all have full-time staff. They care about their programming. They work hard at it. And so you're getting these channels that have hard work behind them put into other markets where I suppose the programming would be appreciated. I know I'd appreciate it. I wouldn't mind having K-Rock, for example, here in Nashville if CBS owned some stations here in Nashville.
I think you're going to see a lot more of this type of brand awareness or brand distribution going on. It may even cross company lines. You know, you may see broadcast companies, say the MS Broadcasting or CBS or Citadel or Clear Channel, making arrangements and deals. Say, hey, you know what? We like your brand in this market. We'd like to bring it to our market and do something with it. Maybe do a rev share or some kind of split commercial inventory arrangement. I know that's kind of far fetched, and people be like, "What are you crazy?" But that type of stuff was done, you know, 20, 30 years ago in the past. I'm not sure why it couldn't happen now.
Something interesting we're doing here in Milwaukee, the Clear Channel stations, we had a Channel 6 here in analog, and of course they would promote their audio on FM radio, and it was actually, you know, fairly popular in the area. Well, of course, when they went digital, that went away. So the Clear Channel stations here did a deal with one of their stations to put Channel 6's audio on one of their HD channels and bring that back, and that seems to be you know, kind of the big buzz lately here with that. And I also, the other thing that on the programming side, I don't know if any of you have seen this, but I've seen a lot of studies lately now with PPM showing that the sports and talk formats are actually doing a lot better than we would have thought of under the old, you know, way of doing things with Arbitron. So I think all the way around, I think it's all good for, you know, not only HD radio, but the business in general.
Well, PPM is so different from the diary recall process that you're getting real-time information and actual, how would you say, life experience. You know, people are experiencing radio in real time, so you're getting stats that never before did we ever expect to have. And sports and talk are probably the most dynamic and active format you could ask for that style of audience measurement.
Now, the trouble with PPM is it's scarily accurate.
Well, yes, I never said that it was an accurate method of audience measurement, but it's a method that people seem to be accepting, which
and just to be clear, I think Peter said it's scarily accurate.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's I can't remember what I had for lunch today. I certainly don't remember what, you know, two or three radio stations I may have punched through today.
But what's unfortunate is, yes, it's scarily accurate, but the amount of the information that you're garnishing from this reception, I don't think is being properly disseminated, because the all news stations that I work with, our format is such that people dip in, check out what's going on, sort of like reading the headlines in a newspaper, and then they jump out. And the data that we get back from PPM makes it look like they're not sampling the station because they don't like it. Meanwhile, they're actually showing people are coming and going as they would expect. Advertisers, programmers, I don't think are interpreting the data correctly.
Okay, so it's a lower TSL, and yes, that scares people off. Yeah.
Exactly. But the reality is, yeah, if you think of the method you're using and what's going on, that's exactly what the format should have. High QM, low TSL. That's good.
Yeah. Yep.
That's what you want. Right. Where if you're a talk station, you probably would want more of a TSL, lower QM, because you want them to stay with you.
Of course. You would hope that they would stay through the hour and listen to what you have to say rather than just, exactly, you know, coming in and sampling every so often.
I can't tell you how many salespeople I talk to that don't get that, and like they're panicking. I said, but you want that high QM in a news format. It may be sports at headline times. No.
Yeah. You don't want a short time spent listening on a music format. I mean, can you imagine every time I punch in, it's that same Britney song? I hate that song. Punch away.
You find, though, that those new CHRs that are launching, I believe CBS does a couple of them, they're kind of fairly tightly rotated CHR stations.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And it's for that reason, for PPM, because it's that whole, you know, every time you turn on the radio, you want to get that, you know, that registration for the PPM meter.
And, but you have to be careful with that.
Yeah.
That's the double-edged sword of PPM. Everyone's abandoning the old traditional methods of diary recall and you know how you made people aware or you reinforce your brand with your listeners. You remember you did promotions, you did maintenance promotions, and every Thursday at 7:30 because the diary started on Thursday and went through the weekend. Well, everyone's abandoned the old techniques of marketing because PPM is given this quick, you know, like a needle shot of information. Mm-hmm. The problem is that needle's hitting a small portion of the surface.
You know what? I think we all just need to get out of engineering and go into programming. It sounds like we have this figured out. I'm telling you.
Yeah, I'll grab my CDs. Where do you want to meet?
There you go. Engineering radio.
Yeah, I never knew an engineer who couldn't program the station better than the PD.
Well, interesting that they thought so many radio stations, it's the engineer who has been there the longest, longer than the PD and any of the disc jockeys and even the general manager of the station.
Well,
we've seen it all, yeah.
Well, you know, I always like to tell people the reason I'm around the longest is because somebody has to be there to change the wiring for the new format.
There you go. So many engineers even stay there longer than through ownership changes.
Yep. Wow. Yeah, I once had a producer tell me the engineers are the cockroaches of the industry. They'll survive anything.
You know, in a lot of cases, that's very true. That's very true, Peter. Yeah. Peter, your stations that you engineered for in Australia, these were they're still owned by Pacific Star Network. Yeah.
Yep, that's right. Yes.
So you have when you were engineering, there's 3MP, is that right?
Yep.
And SEN. And,
yeah, SEN.
I was just looking at the Wikipedia entries for these, and a curiosity popped up. I noticed that in the first days of the station's 3MP, your frequency was 1380 kilohertz, and then in 1978, it switched off of 1380 to a rather odd frequency, odd for those of us in the U.S., a frequency of 1377 kilohertz. Is that right?
Yeah. Back then, they changed the AM spacing or the AM channel width from 10 kilohertz to 9 kilohertz. And so most of the stations had to jump a few kilohertz one way or the other to fit the new channel spacings.
You know, we almost did that here in the U.S. It seems it was back in the about the same time, actually, in the mid to late 70s, I think during the Carter administration, that this idea was floated and U.S. broadcasters were not too excited about it.
Yeah, I think there was a big world radio conference called WARC 72, I think it was, World Administrative Radio Conference, that thrashed around all of these things and tried to get a consistency from continent to continent on spacing. But is South America also 10 kilohertz spacing? Oh, or has it gone to 9?
I think it is. I think they're 10.
I think they're 10 also, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was, well, it's 9 kilohertz spacing pretty much everywhere else. Well, certainly in Europe and Asia. I'm not sure about Africa. But, yeah, that we all had to change. And I do recall getting up early one Sunday morning in 1978, you say it was, sounds about right, to change the crystals in the transmitters and tweak the tuning.
So you had to move 3 kilohertz, which isn't a whole lot, but it did require a little bit of tweaking.
Yeah, well, it required a crystal change primarily.
Yeah.
Now, Kirk, didn't you? Weren't you dealing with one of your stations where you actually had to deal with that 9 versus 10 kilohertz? I remember you telling me a story about that.
Yeah, I'm actually part owner of a couple of radio stations in American Samoa. Now, I'm part owner. I own the part that doesn't make any money. But I purportedly do the engineering there. We have, at the moment, we have 2 FMs, but we also have construction permits for a couple of AM stations. And when we bought one of our AM stations, bought the license, it's licensed to, I believe, 648 kilohertz. So American Samoa, it's out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, south of the equator, and just barely east of the international dateline. American Samoa is part of the area in the world that is on 9 kilohertz spacing, just like Peter was with his stations in Australia. Well, the problem in American Samoa is everybody knows that it's part of America. So when cars are shipped to American Samoa, the car radios are all set up for 10 kilohertz spacing. So that means a station on 648 kilohertz cannot be properly tuned in on a car that you buy in American Samoa.
Well, we had analog tuners, it could be.
Analog tuners could be, sure, but you know, people don't have those anymore in their cars. So in Samoa, our solution was to apply for a different frequency. There are a number of frequencies that are common to both band plans, the 9 kilohertz and the 10 kilohertz band plan, one of those being 900 kilohertz, another being would be like 990, another one would be 810, another would be, down the dial, would be 720. So we ended up applying for and getting construction permits for 720 and 900. So those are common to both band plans. They're legal. They're legal in that area, and the cars can pick them up too. And as soon as we get some money, we're going to build some transmitter sites. So it's so interesting, the whole world of standards. It's they're a beautiful thing because there are so many of them. Just take your pick.
Yeah, well, speaking of standards, down in if I'm not mistaken, Peter, down in Australia, with the AM stations, you've got a heck of a lot tighter standards on RF exposure than we do here in the United States. I was just wondering, what are the standards down there? For example, with a 5 kilowatt tower, how close can you actually get to it before you've got to start doing the time averaging and everything else?
I guess what we're what we have to do is we've had to about 3 or 4 years ago have a full RF survey of the site and come up with areas that are suitable for occupational exposure and areas that are suitable for non-occupational exposure. And on a 5 kilowatt, the way it's worked out is that If you've got a block of real estate that's big enough for a directional antenna system to fit on, typically non-occupational will fall within your property, so you don't have a problem unless you're really unlucky and you've got a tower close to a boundary. But you wouldn't want to do that because you wouldn't be able to get your radials out properly from it. So it's not a practical problem for us. Occupational exposure is typically that you might have to reduce power if you want to work on an ATU that's close to the tower or on the tower. Beyond that, it hasn't been a practical problem for us, but it certainly is much more stringent than it ever was. People are more aware of it. Riggers won't climb live towers anymore, where once upon a time they'd happily climb up a wooden step ladder and jump onto a tower and climb up and change lights or do work on it. Nowadays, it's you're de-energizing the tower and grounding it before they'll even look at it.
Yeah, well, it's the same in the States here. I remember the days when guys, they wouldn't think twice about jumping on the tower. Matter of fact, I had a 50 kilowatt one day, and I told the guy, when you're ready to come down the tower, you pick up the two-way radio, you call me, I'll drop it, I'll let you know when it's safe. And he just jumped off the tower and drew an arc to his hand all the way to the ground.
He was
not a happy guy.
Oh.
Hermes. Wow. His name is Hermes.
Wow. We're going to hear more about broadcasting in Australia and answer our listeners' questions in a few minutes. I want to, though, mark just a couple of more items that are topical in the news right now. I want to mention a couple of luminaries who have passed on. One of those is Don Markley. D.L. Markley and Associates in Peoria, Illinois, was Don's company, and I had the pleasure of working with Don on several occasions. In fact, one time back in the early 1990s, we worked together for several days on the roof of the Sears Tower in Chicago. Don Markley was 73 years old, and he started his company, D.L. Markley and Associates, back in 1964. Along with his wife, Phyllis. And Phyllis will continue running the company. Jeremy Ruck is the senior engineer there, and he will continue doing the day-to-day engineering operations. Did anyone on this panel work with Don Markley for any projects?
No, cannot say that I've had the pleasure.
Unfortunately, no.
Yeah, he did a lot of television engineering, did a lot of directional AMs earlier on, and then did also a lot of television engineering. In fact, designed the original television transmission plan for the top of the Sears Tower and quite a few other high-profile sites. Also, another gentleman passing just in the last couple of days from when, or actually just in the last couple of days from when this podcast is being recorded, was Lewis King of Kintronic Labs. Lewis Arthur King started that business in 1949, and of course, Kintronic Labs continues today. I just had a real pleasure of meeting with having some dinner with Tom King. That's Lewis's son, who runs the company now. I'm sure anybody in AM broadcast has, at one time or another, dealt with Kintronic Labs.
We use the Kintronic Labs phaser cabinets at our place.
Yeah, we use the Kintronic Labs antenna switches.
Yep, mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, and a lot of Kintronic parts, at least, are used by engineering consultants who put together systems in Australia, too. They buy them in for their own systems.
Well, I know that Kintronic will go on. Tom King is a very smart guy, and also Gwen there is also part of running their business. So, in fact, I've very lucky. I've been invited to go visit them next spring. Going to probably head over to the Bristol NASCAR Speedway as well and spend some time with them there. So, anyway, Lewis King passed away just a couple of days ago. All right, let's see, what else are we going to get to today? I think we have a couple of listener questions, and I think probably the biggest one, I'll tell you what, let's save the big one for last. That's Peter's question that he posed a few days ago. Let's real quickly get to some questions from our website, from thisweekinradiotech.com, and Brian Urban wrote us, and he asks an interesting question: what is the future of radio? Time for a crystal ball. So what are the impacts of streaming, MP3 players, and Wi-Fi and WiMAX, and as we've talked about, LTE coming along? What are the impacts of these things in the automobile and portable radios? If HD radio isn't the answer, I'm not sure it isn't, but if it isn't, what is the answer to delivering instant communications and entertainment and information to the masses?
Good programming. Well,
Yeah, exactly.
Content.
That's what engineering always says, isn't it?
No, but this is the best time. The radio industry, this is the best time for radio industry right now. Is the technologies are bursting at the seam. The only thing that holds you back is your imagination. You know, to try and do a velvet rope garden type of business model, you're an idiot. Plain and simple. You can't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. That goes true for the phone companies. Cable companies, the whole bit. People are consuming content at will or on demand, whatever you want to use. And if you don't get into that mindset, you will be left behind.
And I think that with all the content, he's talking Wi-Fi, putting it in cars and such. When you have all that competition, hopefully some people are going to start getting creative. I mean, you can only play the same 300 songs so many times before you have to start branching out.
But, you know, go ahead.
Go ahead, Chris.
Oh, I was going to say, has anybody seen, it was released yesterday or today, the article about the Council for Research Excellence and Nielsen study on radio versus MP3 iPod usage, that sort of thing?
No, I hadn't seen it.
Yeah, 90% of adults are exposed to some form of audio on a daily basis. Broadcast radio, though, having by far the largest reach of listening
time.
That's
correct.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. I'm just kind of skimming through it here. Broadcast and satellite radio is 79% daily reach with 122 minutes. CD and tapes, 37% with 72 minutes. And what most people are kind of surprised about, MP3s made up 11% or an hour. And then computer streaming was 9.3% with 67 minutes. And audio on mobile phones, less than 2% or 9 minutes.
Yeah. Mm. You know why? You know why it's that way? Because the only medium that you spoke of in that survey that has a ubiquitous access is radio. If I want to listen to my favorite radio station on the internet, I have to use the radio station's player. If I want to listen to my favorite radio station on the radio, I can pick up any model from model 1 to model 1000. It won't matter. And that's the problem. You want to listen to a clear channel station? iHeartRadio. You want to listen to CBS? AOL Radio. That's the problem. You can't do that.
The other thing, too, is that radio is live and local. I mean, I can't go on a website in the car and hear it. Well, I could with my Sprint card, but...
You can with your Motorola iRadio at some point.
Yeah, but I mean, the bottom line is I can't find out what the traffic's like going through the Lincoln or the Holland tunnels.
True.
I need the information right here, right now.
You know what I find interesting is, let's say Steve Jobs walks out on stage and he talks about this great new device that they have. You can get music anywhere. It gives you local traffic and weather. It's portable. It's small. Everybody would go nuts. And then all of a sudden you go, yeah, it's a radio. That's the thing. We get such a bad rap because of the iPods and the streaming and that sort of thing. When really, you know, it goes back to the basics. There's just nothing that beats that. It doesn't require a lot of power to use. You can get them anywhere. They're cheap. They're available. They work well. They're easy to use. And all of those things. Just, it's going to be a long time before anything else can get close to that.
Yeah, and people don't have to think too much to listen to the radio. They just switch it on, and it's there, and it's providing them minute by minute with
exactly
the kind of information that they want, and they don't have to work at it.
That's the key. The user interface for radio is matured, and it's been perfected, and it works.
Well, and here's something else, and there's a lot of people out there talking about the WiMAX and Wi-Fi and cellular data and things, and I mean, there's no doubt that those are making some inroads, but if you think about, if you try to think of the future about how these radios are going to work, let's say everybody could stream in their cars. Imagine, rush hour in New York City, everybody trying to stream data from cell towers, for their ride home in rush hour. The kind of capacity that you would need and the cost to provide that kind of capacity, at least in today's terms, is mind-boggling.
I don't think there's enough spectrum to do that. I mean, it's bad enough with just cell phone calls during rush hour in New York City.
True. There's some thought that needs to be put into that, but I don't think it's too far off. I think the problem we're experiencing as an industry is we're not paying attention to the end user. Any successful product, and it could be from widgets for soda cans to iPods if we'll use a brand name, it's the end user. How will they consume it and use it? Radio has stopped doing that. If you look back at the history of radio and read all those books and the pictures and show what was going on, back 75 years of radio, the one common theme in anything you read or see in those books is the local radio content. The disc jockey, the newscaster, the sportscaster, or the radio personality, whatever, talking to the local folks. Local could be anything from a large city to a small town. I'm not saying it has to be a population of 500 or less. That's the key. Today, how much of that really goes on? It doesn't.
Well, I've got a great story. In fact, I'm going up. I'm taking 2 days off. I've got to go up and work on a project there. But two very good friends of mine started a Class A radio station, got the permit, in auction, and really built it from the ground up. I do their engineering work. Up in Door County, Wisconsin, small little community. Before they turned their radio station on, they did a lot of research into what people are into up there, what they like, their interests and things like that. Signed on this radio station, and although it's not live all the time, it's all completely local and geared towards the community. Members of the community participate. And, 6 months in, they signed on with no advertise, with no promotions or whatever, just turn on the transmitter and started going. Checked in with him 6 months later, and he said, the only problem we have is I can't keep up with the people wanting to advertise. And it solved its own problem. I mean, he's having no problem, even in this economy, making money because, everybody's listening because it serves that community and the advertisers support that. And it's a great example of really, in some places, what's missing today in radio.
It's a simple formula. That's the thing. It's so simple, people don't believe it can work. Just on your topic of local radio, not here in the New York area, but outside the New York area, at the very tip, eastern tip of Long Island, is a small town. It's not small by any standard anymore, but it's a nice rural town called Sag Harbor. And in Sag Harbor, there's one radio station that's been there for some 20 years or more, WLNG. This is a radio station that transmits in mono. They turn off the pilot. There's no stereo signal. The music format is oldies. And then it's mixed in with all local content from swap and shops and newscasts, or you name it, they do it. And that radio station generates something like, I think, like $200,000 a month this, you know, it's a 3,000 watt AM Class A. Just, it's cranking out. They can't keep up with the advertisers. Again, local content.
Wow.
They have, and they have stations. The best part of it is on the eastern end of Long Island, there are at least another half a dozen radio stations of higher power or equal power. Some of them are owned and operated by very large companies. They're barely, you know, paying the bills every month. They're crying poverty. This radio station, by the way, did I mention they have three mobile studios they use on the island? One of them is an RTS GM bus they purchased used. They spent $150,000 to build out a mobile studio from a city bus, and they take that to every place they can. Okay, this is a radio station that is not rated. There are no ratings that they can really use. It's a station that probably is, you know, if you think about it in terms of revenue compared to a radio station that I'm employed by, it's a small pimple on the back of an elephant. But yet, they can purchase a city bus, outfit it, and go out and do events. Where I work at stations that, yeah, you know, we'd like to do that, but we just can't justify the expense. Hello?
Chris, I didn't know what an RTS bus is. Holy cow, this is a bus!
Yes!
It's a rapid
yes.
transit. This is a, like, this is a city
right.
bus. Oh, my
That's
goodness.
That's correct.
And this is a little 3,000-watt station that
yes.
has three mobile units, and this is one of them.
That's correct.
Wow. That warms my heart. That is just great to hear about these stations. Chris Tarr, the guys that you know in Door County, and Chris Tobin, these guys in Sag Harbor. Wow, that is just amazing. We should try to collect some more success stories like this. Actually, a friend of mine is a member of a group called the International Broadcasters Idea Bank, or the IBIB. And they get together a couple times a year. Some of their owners are, in fact, a lot of their owners, station owners, are small-time operators, or they have just a few stations, and they are the kind of people that operate their stations live and local as much as possible. That is,
In New York, I mean, let's take a look at our station, WR. We do a lot of remotes. Basically, yeah, I mean, we're a New York City radio station. Yet we are a small town radio station. We go out, we do all these remotes with people. We bring in some stars. We go out and have lunch. You come in, you have lunch with the air staff. You're on the air with them, and we just go out and do it. And let me tell you, if Joan Hamburg goes out someplace and she goes to Sardi's and she says, you know, well, we're going to bring Alan Alda in today, they'll sell the place out.
Sure,
exactly.
For lunch. I mean, and people love that stuff.
Hmm. I wonder I live in Nashville, so we certainly have plenty of stars here. And some stations here in Nashville do go out and do a lot of remotes. We have a music station here where I live called Lightning 100. In fact, we'll have their engineer, Tom Hansen, on the show, on a future show. He's a very interesting guy. And he engineers a ton of remotes that are all live music events. That's the sort of remotes that they do. They're very music-oriented. And, of course, Nashville has no shortage of live music going on. Any other stations? Chris, Tarr, do any of your stations do live musical events?
Actually, we do, although they're not mobile events. Our station in Madison, Triple M, is a very artist and singer-songwriter-driven type of format. And when we remodeled the facility, I actually built a performance studio in the building where we have artists come in when they're touring. You know, maybe they're in town for a concert or whatever. They'll stop by. We'll bring listeners in. And we'll do a live performance, and we also master the recordings. And usually once a year or so, once or twice a year, we'll create a CD for charity where we sell these performances on CD. So, you know, and it's interesting to see, you know, it's a very one-on-one. And for these people, it's all about the experience. And those are things, you know, and that radio can do that nobody else can do in terms of touching people, you know, and giving them an experience as opposed to just something to listen to. You know, people come and they meet these artists and they have these very, intimate performances. And, you know, they walk away from that. That's something that you can't get anywhere else.
Peter, how about Australia? What is localism like there with the stations you were at?
Localism's very strong in most radio stations in Australia, particularly in the metro areas, perhaps a little less in the regional areas where there's a reliance on satellite delivery of centralized programming out of peak hours. But our sports station, for example, is it's live 24/7, has a lot of retired sports stars, if you like, as presenters or personalities on the station, and that drives a lot of remotes, or outside broadcasters, we call them here, because you put down a couple of people who've been award-winning sports stars that are well known in the city, and you put them down in the centre of the city for a major outside broadcast for a particular purpose, and it can draw crowds of thousands of people, but on a day-by-day basis, they'd probably be out and about once or twice a week, and the music station is less remote driven, because there's not as much of a draw for having an announcer introducing a sweep of music and just sitting there and listening to the music in between, so you don't get the same kind of audience participation on them. So there's less of them, but there's always a lot of listener involvement with the station through promotions and competitions and that sort of thing. So the stations are a part of the community. They're understood to be a part of the community, and I guess the same goes for a lot of our competitors too. The stations are well known in the community, and they're always being involved in the community, and that's the difference with radio from some of these other media.
Thinking then about Brian Urban's original question, getting back to that, what I hear everyone saying is that it's all about the content and not so much about the delivery method. Now, as engineers, that's a real convenient way. It sounds like a convenient way to pass the buck, but I want to say that as the professionals that are gathered here in this podcast, and I got to believe almost every engineer I've ever met is interested in whatever the content is, and we sure hope it's good and compelling, whatever that content is, let's get it delivered in the best way possible, or let's get it delivered with the media that we have to deal with. Let's make it sound the best and work the best. Now, I got a complaint. I got to say that a lot of stations, for whatever reason, whether it's downfall of engineering or not an engineer there on site or whatever, a lot of stations are falling down and tripping up on this. I have certainly heard plenty of dead silent HD2 and HD3 stations. I've heard internet streams that sounded horrible. I've also heard internet streams that are up and down and up and down as far as being on or off. Whenever they go to commercial break, it's dead air for a while, or just the same old thing running again. Hey, thanks for listening to our stream. Of course, that can be a programming issue and not an engineering issue. What's our responsibility as engineers to make things work as well as possible?
Kirk, first thing I'd say is that's sad, but the really sad thing is that as engineers, we've lost our positions of authority in the radio stations.
Absolutely.
And, we're far longer ago than I care to admit, when I first joined the radio station, the whole station, including the manager, respected the chief engineer, and what the chief engineer said went. And that's certainly not the case now. And the ability to be able to have the resources to maintain the engineering of the station to a level to be able to ensure reliable delivery of the product, that's just disappeared.
Well, you know, here's something else, this is very indicative of what's happening today. For example, for six radio stations, it's me and a part-time guy. And, you know, it is even with all of the safeguards that I have in place and all the notification systems and things, you see that everywhere. You know, unfortunately, one of the downsides of consolidation is it used to be one engineer for one station or one engineer for two stations, sometimes two engineers for a station. Now it's down to one person for a building. And it used to be just you take care of, you know, two terrestrial, an AM and an FM or something. And now you've got AM, you've got FM, you've got HD, you've got HD2, you've got streams. You know, I went from when I started at Intercom having, you know, just three, you know, two FMs and an AM. Now I've got, you know, aside from Madison, I've got two FMs and AM. Two of the FMs have HD2s. They all stream. So I've got all of these, you know, going from three to 6 to 9 different methods of delivering content. Still one person. So I think a lot of what you're seeing too is not as much that people don't care as much as, you know, these workloads have doubled and tripled, or these delivery methods, and, you know, trying to stay on top of all of them has become a challenge.
Chris, you said 6 stations. Don't you have some HDs there as well?
Well, that's what I'm talking about. I was using Milwaukee as an example, but I've got HD going on in Madison too. So, so I've got, you know, if you add all that in, I have, you know, 5 FMs and an AM, plus, you know, 3 of those are doing HD, 2 of those are doing HD2. They all stream, and all of those are priorities. And, you know, so when one of them isn't working, I jump to it. But, you know, it used to be where it was just the transmitters you had to worry about. Now you've got all these other layers. And, you know, I'd like to think, oh, yeah, we added more people to help with that, but we haven't. And that's a pretty common situation pretty much with any group of radio stations.
Would we, as conscientious engineers, would we be helping our industry by extending a friendly hand to engineers of stations that we know have problems? I don't think it helps the radio industry when I tune into an HD2 and it ain't there. Sounds horrible.
I think you see that in a lot of markets, Kirk. I mean, for example, if I heard something at one point on one of the CBS FMs when they were removing something, I called Chris's boss, Mark Olkowski, and said, "Hey, Mark, here's what I'm hearing on the station. Thought you'd like to know." And he listened. He said, "Oh my God," you know, and took care of it. On the other hand, Chris has called me when he's heard something. When I used to work at Hartford, for God's sake, we had 7 Harris FM25K transmitters in the market, and between all of us who had these transmitters, we probably could have built another one with the spare parts every one of us had. Everybody knew who had what part, and if something blew, it's Sunday morning at 2 a.m., you could get on the phone, pick up, call the guy who had the part and say, "Can I go get it, or can you meet me someplace?" And it wasn't a big deal. So that does go on, but when you're strung out with 6 stations and a lot of times you don't have time to go, go help that other guy up the street. And unfortunately, that's what we come to nowadays.
Even in Milwaukee, I've got keys to some of the transmitter buildings for some of our competitors and vice versa. So, I mean, we do that. We're on each other's call lists for support and for backup. And, you know, so we do that, and that helps. But, you know, it's just there, you know, and it's not even just a matter of being conscientious. There's a lack of engineers coming into the business. So, you know, those people are starting to dry up a little bit.
Aren't there station owners or managers who would just be horrified at what's been said here in the last minute?
Probably.
I would hope so, but I don't know if that's always going to be the case.
Well, to a large extent, engineers have always helped each other out, despite sometimes the instruction or feelings of upper management. Because it's a competitive ball game out there, and we've got to do our best and be loyal to our stations. But if somebody else is off the air and you've got a part that can help them, I think it's good for radio to have.
Well, not only that, but if the competition's not there anymore, it's no longer fun if you're not competing.
I mean, seriously, think about it.
You know,
that's part of the problem. Yeah. The competition's been reduced to the point now it's like 3 large groups in a market, and they all have their own professional courtesy amongst themselves, and that's it, and then nothing's going on. But I think also part of it is the engineers themselves, us techies, or however you want to put it, the discipline of engineering or technology has never lent itself to 2 things. 1, social contact with others, and 2, a sort of business sense. I'm sitting here with technology and developing things, and this is a great whiz-bang widget. However, I don't have the wherewithal to take it to my managers or say to the company that I'm employed by and say, "By the way, if we do this widget for these club broadcasts you want to do, we can actually save X number of dollars, put more to the bottom line, and appear in the market as being the king of the hill." That doesn't happen. Instead, what happens now is the non-traditional broadcasters come into the market with the technology we're playing with, we'll say Skype or these webcams and everything else that's out there. And they present it to the managers, who have no idea what this is about, but figure that these people do because they're younger, they're into that new thing, and it must be the panacea that we're looking for. I only say that from personal experience, because I've gone through this a dozen times with the corporation I'm employed by.
See, I'm a little more fortunate. I mean, I do a lot of that. I'm almost kind of the guy who comes in with those ideas. And in fact, I'm challenged quite a bit from the general manager on up to come up with these sorts of things in creative ways to solve these problems. So it's a little different in my position, but you're right. I mean, there's, and to our, I guess, and I don't want to say in our defense, but, you know, we rightfully so kind of have a bad rap as engineers in general in terms of, you know, how many times has a program director come in and said, I want to be able to do this. And the first reply is, well, what do you want to do that for? Oh,
exactly.
I really want to do that. Yep. You know, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. That's part of the problem. I mean, I witnessed that a lot. And, you know, I talk to folks and I've talked to program directors about stuff and they'll ask a question like, hey, you know, we're trying to do X, Y, and Z, and I'm not sure how to explain it. I'll sit there and go, you want to be able to do this, 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 and this, right? Yeah, how'd you know? Don't worry about how I knew. How do you want to get to the goal?
Yep, exactly.
That's what you need more of. You need more of that. And hopefully, if you did that more and more, the general manager, the owner, whomever, will look at you and go, wow, this guy is more of an asset than I thought. Because right now, technically, in the world of accounting, the engineer at the radio station is a financial liability on the ledger sheet. Unlike the account executive, who they perceive as somebody who brings in the revenue.
Yeah, we're the guys who spend it all the time, unfortunately.
Right. Right. But, yeah. I will fault many a manager of a company for not paying attention to basic business. You don't break up your assets and the human asset for any company, whether it's telephones, bookmaking, or videotaping, is your key. Without the human asset, your widget goes nowhere. Okay. And outsourcing proved that. That's the trick. Managers today are not being properly managed or the corporations or the companies are not saying, hey, we're not making the number. Don't cut expenses to make the number. Show me another method. We need to sit down and talk. And Tom knows the company I used to work for many, many years ago called Chase Broadcasting.
Yep.
Chase Broadcasting had the attitude of, hey, I don't care what the cost is per se. Let's sit down and discuss what we're going to do to dominate the market.
Right.
No one does that anymore. Today's people, today they dominate the market by buying out the competition or some, crazy under the table routine, or maybe just coming up with excuses as to why they can't and we'll just accept it as is.
And you know what's always puzzled me, Chris, is I was at a party once. My wife used to work for, of all places, Lego. She had a cool job for a cool company.
Yeah.
But they, we went to the Christmas party one night, and you sit around the table with all these people you don't know, and well, what do you do? Well, I work in radio. Oh, really? What do you do? Well, I'm an engineer. And then you get the blank stare. It's like, no. So I explained it to these people in a way that they could understand. I'm the shipping and receiving department.
It is
what I am. I take in program content from satellites, or I take it in from the studio. I package it up and I ship it, and the transmitter is my truck.
Exactly.
And unfortunately, we don't think that way anymore in this business. And at Lego, they would never think of not changing the oil in the truck because they wouldn't be able to get things to market.
Right. Right. Exactly. That is the crux of the problem.
Guys, we're the distribution method.
Yeah.
Right. Yes.
Exactly. Speaking of distribution, we got probably time for one more question and answer. And the reason Peter Smurden is with us today is because he wrote in on our website, thisweekinradiotech.com, and asked a question. And Peter, would you like to go ahead and share your question with us since you're on with us?
Okay. Yeah. Well, one of the areas of concern that I've got with digital radio is transcoding errors. Or some people call it cascading or dueling algorithms. And I'm concerned about remote broadcasts and bringing audio in via bitrate reduced contribution circuits and then recoding it in the digital audio coders, perhaps using a different algorithm. What are you guys finding with that? Is that a practical problem for you, or hasn't it come up yet?
Well, we do a lot of remote broadcasting at WOR, and I haven't we found a couple of things. For example, ISDN, a layer 3 codec doesn't play very nice with the HD radio codec. I mean, it does, but the way I describe it, what I hear is I hear a halo around the audio,
talk radio. I want to set the stage just a second. When you say the HD radio codec, I take it you're talking about the AM version on WOR AM.
Yes, that's correct.
And that's a pretty low bit rate, is it not?
It's 32 kilobits.
32 kilobits per second. It's from what we know about the HD radio codec, it's probably got some of the coding technologies, fake high end in there.
That's what I would guess. But yeah. but I mean this. I haven't quite figured out what is going on yet, but like I said, it sounds like there's this halo around the audio. Is the best way I can describe. If you could see the audio, there'd be a halo. But I find, like, for example, on ISDN, if we were to use AAC, sounds pretty good.
Doesn't AAC closely approximate the HD radio codec?
Yeah, it's kind of an offshoot of AAC.
It is. So they would play nicely together. We found that layer two tends to kind of play nice with that. You get things like a Comrex Access. That actually sounds very, believe it or not, sounds very good when you put it through the HD radio codec.
And on the Access, you're using Comrex's brick codec?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Has anybody used APTX?
Because I've used it at WINS. At CBS, used it.
Yeah, because that's an entirely different codec scheme, isn't it? ADPCM versus the perceptual codecs that the other systems use.
Yes, absolutely. I found it works. I prefer APTX coding when I use on some T1 links and when I have ISDN codecs that support it. And I find the latency is less, the quality of the audio is much better, and it survives getting, if you will, transmitted, decoded, recoded, re-encoded two or three times before it starts to sound squirrely.
Mm-hmm.
That's always been one of APTX's selling points. When I worked for Scott Studios years ago, back 15 years ago, that was the codec that we were promoting. One reason was because we could hardware key it and perhaps save our software from being duplicated. But more importantly, it was also because it was not a psychoacoustic algorithm. It was a pretty much a hard math algorithm.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
Right. Well, after a pass or two, you run out of bits to rob in those psychoacoustic types of codecs. So, you know, you maybe get one or two passes there and then you're done.
Yeah. Depending on the bit rate. I think that the studies have shown that if you're using a really high bit rate, MPEG layer 2 at 300 or 400 or 500 kilobits per second, AAC at that kind of a high bit rate also, and APTX at that kind of a high bit rate, you can code and recode quite a few times and not suffer too much deleterious effect. When you get down into a bit rate like 128 kilobits per second, well, you're not going to be using APTX at 128 kilobits per second. So we've also got to look at what is available to you on your transmission medium. If you're using an ISDN, a pair of ISDN lines for a total of 128 kilobits per second, what's the best thing to use? And Tom, you alluded that MP3 doesn't sound so good when it's recoded by the HD radio code at 32 kilobits per second on AM.
But well, at least not the low bitrate stuff. Typically you'd be running 56 or 64 kilobits a channel on the MP3 stuff on the ISDN.
Yeah.
I suppose it wouldn't sound that bad if you ran it at a higher data rate, but
I think one thing that's important is that not just because a low bitrate is available to us in the gear that we're using doesn't mean it's a good idea. And doesn't mean that ought to be the default. I mean, my understanding of MPEG Layer 2 is that the target bitrate for MPEG Layer 2 has been and always has been a minimum of 256 kilobits per second. But there are plenty of satellite networks that use it at 192 or even 128 kilobits per second. And DAB in Great Britain, they're using MPEG Layer 2 at 128 kilobits per second, and that is just too slow. It sounds gritty and grimy at that kind of bit.
Some of them are down to 64 kilobits per second, I hear.
Ouch.
Aye, aye, aye. Yeah, that's the realm for AAC, HE or AAC, HEV2. These do, and I'm not saying that they're good for contribution quality. We should make that distinction, by the way. What is contribution quality and what is transmission quality? And in the world of delivering bits to the consumer, most of the time, that's the link where we have the least bit rate, with whether it's HD radio at 96 or 64 or 32 kilobits per second, or whether it's an IP stream over the internet at maybe 64 or 48 kilobits per second, maybe 128 if they're doing that. This transmission to the end user, that's going to be our weak link in many cases. With the advent of doing IP remotes, one of our difficulties is that if we choose to use a codec at 24 or 48 kilobits per second, Now we've just added the second weak link. We've added a coding of the audio from the source, from the remote site, that is a bit damaged when it comes into the studio. And we transmit that again at another low bit rate to our listeners. Now, if we just put that out on FM analog or AM analog, you know, it's not bad. It's listenable. Nope. But if we code that again, as Peter first alluded to in his question, if we do this cascaded coding, we can get into some serious trouble there and develop some audio that's tough to listen to.
And unfortunately, these days, you know, sometimes you don't have a choice getting it back to the station with what you're going to do. I mean, they develop all these great technologies for television stations to get from point A to point B, yet in radio, we have RPU bandwidth taken away from us. We have the phone companies no longer do landlines. Now they're talking about getting rid of ISDN. So at some point, you have to say, whoa, what are you going to do now? You know, it's...
Well, I think the other thing that we have to keep in mind with the new digital realm is not only the codec, the algorithm, the filtering masks that are involved, whether it be MPEG or if it's APTX and the math crunching, but also how the mechanism that you use to get the audio into that codec. Because something we've discovered at the stations I'm working with, and since we do a lot of news and sports, we're all over the place, and even at the music stations, but more of the voice, I've discovered over the years working at many other jobs, the quality of the microphone and the type of pre-processing that you put in front of the codec can actually give you several dB of enhanced, or you know, I'll say it's enhanced sound, but better control of the codec.
Chris, can you give away a secret or two? What should we be looking for to feed a codec?
Well, believe it or not, I mean, it's no secret. I've found that omnidirectional microphones, dynamic mics, seem to work the best. The trick is finding a very smooth... you know, a relatively flat microphone. You know how an RE20 or RE27, which is directional to some degree, has a 10 kilohertz boost in it, and it's got a, you know, those are things you want to stay away from. Because I've noticed, because again, the other thing you have to deal with is the voice, the symmetry of a voice, whether male or female, asymmetrical, positive or asymmetrical, negative. I've discovered that tears apart codecs as well. The Comrex codec works great with symmetrical voices to a degree. Male voices that are asymmetrical have a gravel sound to them, if you will. Mm-hmm. It falls apart. Same is true with MPEG with the same type of voice. APTX, though, seems to be very robust, but it's tough running that at low bit rates. I mean, 128 you can get away with, but lower than that, you probably will run into problems. But that's what I've discovered. And lately, I've been doing broadcasts with the Beyer M58 dynamic microphone. And I've been using that for years. And unsolicited, I've had reporters, jocks, talk show hosts say to me, wow, I'm not sure what we're using to do those interviews, but boy, it sounds great. In our air studios, we switched from RE27s to SM7 microphones. I took a lot of heat for that. But 6 months later, I've got almost everybody saying, wow, listening to the air checks, can't believe how much better it sounds. I'm like, well, what do you hear that's different? I hear more of my inflection, my lower resonance. You know, the overall sound that you hear when you talk to someone in person.
Isn't that interesting?
See, you know, here's something that people tend to forget with these, especially the perceptual codecs, is they need a lot of audio and a lot of clean audio to work with.
Exactly.
Do their magic. And, you know, a lot of people handicap themselves going in by, you know, getting cheap mics or, you know, not really thinking about, you know, the type of cabling you're using, the type of, you know, even like, are you using a beat up Shure mixer to feed it, you know?
Absolutely. I mean,
those are all things you know, before when you were all dealing in the analog realm and through Marty systems and things like that, that wasn't really important. And, you know, you need to take all that stuff that's left over and throw it away and really look at the bigger picture.
You don't want to waste bits coding rubbish.
Right, exactly. Right. Buzz, pumps, and, you know, that sort of thing.
And another thing that people tend to do is they tend to be afraid to drive that codec fairly close to the zero point. And of course, the harder you drive it without clipping, the more precise and the more defined the audio is going to be. If you have it, you know, peaking away at minus 25 or minus 20, it's going to sound significantly different than if you have it peaking up near zero.
You got to give it bits.
I think one piece of advice for just about any codec is that codecs were designed, and we're talking about, for those tuning in wondering what I mean by a codec, this is an algorithm that turns what is essentially 1.5 or 2 megabit per second digital sampling. When you have an analog to digital converter, you have this high bit rate of linear audio going on. And a codec is going to take this and somehow squeeze it down to some very low bit rate, anywhere from maybe as low as 8 or 16 kilobits per second to maybe 2, 3, 4, 500 kilobits per second in the case where you've got a lot of bandwidth available. And how is it going to do that? There are different methods for getting this done, but most codecs are psychoacoustic in nature. We take out parts of the audio that we think that the codec designer thinks you can't hear, and actually decreases the signal to noise ratio of what's left to just beyond the limits of human perception. So the bottom line is these codecs were designed to handle natural audio. Audio that hasn't been overly processed, certainly audio that hasn't been clipped like we do with certain transmission schemes, AM and FM transmission schemes. So for any codec, we want to feed it audio that's of a consistent level, that doesn't have wide excursions in frequency response, like way too much bass or way too much high end. And we also have to bandwidth limit the audio so we're not above what's called the Nyquist frequency. But we also want to feed it audio that is clean and free of distortion itself. Distortion is distortion by definition has harmonics in it, and we don't want to have to also code those harmonics. We want it, right, audio that's as pure and sweet and natural as possible, and that's how we'll get the best performance at the other end when we decode this audio back into something we can listen to.
It needs dynamic range in order to work. I mean, that's really the bottom line is, yes, it's got to rob bits from somewhere, and it tries to rob bits you can't hear. So if everything is pegged against the wall and brick wall limited and things like that, it can't rob anything. You know, there's nowhere to take those bits from.
Here's today's experiment for our listeners at home and also for the co-hosts on this podcast. I got to do this one time at Telos years ago. Before I worked for Telos, they invited me up to look at some technologies they had. And they had a few devices spread out on the test bench. And by the way, what I'm going to tell you here is a little bit of how a perceptual audio codec works. They had two tone generators, okay? And they mixed them together and put them into a speaker, an amplifier and a speaker, so we could hear these two tone generators. And we also had an audio spectrum analyzer to show the audio portion of the spectrum here. So we could turn up one tone generator. Let's say we put it at 800 hertz and made a tone at 800 hertz and turned it up so we could hear it. And we could also see it on the spectrum analyzer, this pip of energy at 800 hertz. Well, then we'd take the other spectrum analyzer, and maybe we'd set it to about, 1100 hertz. And we would turn its volume up mixed with the 800 hertz. And you know what? We turn it up, and at first we couldn't hear it. But we could see it on the spectrum analyzer. We could see its level. Maybe it was, 30 or 40 decibels lower than the 800. And we'd bring its level up and bring its level up and bring its level up until finally we noticed, now I can hear that other tone. But we could see it on the spectrum analyzer well before we could actually hear it with our ears. Well, we turned the level of the second tone down to where we couldn't hear it anymore, but we could still see it on the spectrum analyzer. Then we turn off the first tone. Well, when we turned off the first tone, which was louder, we could easily hear the leftover tone, the one that we couldn't hear in the presence of the first tone. And this is the effect of acoustic masking. The loudest tone, or the loudest sound over a certain range of frequencies masks all others that are below the skirt of this mask. And this is how a psychoacoustic encoder works. It just doesn't code stuff that you can't hear or that it thinks you can't hear. And of course, the lower the bit rate that you tell it to do, the more aggressive it gets with this technology. And when you get too low of bit rate, why, it's overly aggressive and you end up with audio that doesn't sound quite like what you put into it. So there's our quick lesson today on psychoacoustic coding.
Well, if you want to get an idea of how well your codec's going to work, what I used to do, I still do from time to time, is take a square wave, take an audio generator, generate a square wave, run it through the codec, look at the output, and the more you'll learn the points, it's almost like a Bessel function on a transmitter. Yeah. You'll see exactly where it falls apart, where it seems to say, we'll say it's flat or you know, unity gain, and where you need to balance out the in to out as far as how much input you want to give it. And I used to do that years ago for some satellite stuff I did. And boy, oh boy, you learn real fast. You don't want to be cranking everything up when you're doing digital audio. You're almost finding yourself going the other way.
Yeah, exactly.
And I can't seem to stress that to folks I work with when they're setting up processing, and they're like, no, it's got to be more. I'm like, no, you're actually going the wrong way.
With digital, less is better.
Yes, exactly.
less is more, so many things in life. Guys, we have burned up another hour and 5 minutes or so, and certainly had a wonderfully interesting podcast. We have a question that we didn't get to about EQing microphones, and we'll just have to save that for another podcast, maybe for next week. By the way, just as a programming note, the podcast that will be appearing next week, this would be... let's see here. Do I have a calendar in front of me? No, I don't. What is the date next Wednesday or Thursday? That would be about the 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, about the 11th or 12th or so?
Yep, the 11th.
Yeah, the 11th.
Yeah, the 11th. Yep. Well, we're recording that podcast tomorrow. So some of you will be here, some can't. We've got a couple of new people coming in. So we will have a podcast every week on This Week in Radio Tech, but we are doing two of them this week. I want to thank everybody for participating. Thank you so much. First of all, we'll go in reverse order. Chris Tobin from New York City, thank you for being with us. Chris with CBS Radio.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Tom Ray with Buckley Broadcasting in New York also.
Anytime, Kirk. It's always enjoyable.
From Down Under, from Melbourne, Australia, Peter Smurden. Peter, thank you so much for joining us and putting an hour of your day into this.
You're welcome, Kirk. It's been a blast.
And we'd like to have you back again and like to hear some of your war stories about AM transmission in Australia. And more importantly, I want to hear about DAB broadcasting, where you think this is going in Australia. But we're going to have to do that another time. Will you be able to join us again, Peter?
Sure will, yeah.
All right.
Happy to.
And Chris Tarr from Milwaukee and Wisconsin, also Madison and Entercom.
Yep, be sure to check out my site, geekjedi.com.
That would be spelled geek like G-E-E-K and then Jedi like Yoda the Jedi?
You got it.
GeekJedi.com. Very cool. And thank you for joining us here on This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host, and we'll see you again next week.